Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 865. Interview with Peter Lavenda about Ratline and Unholy Alliance. This is being recorded on September 27th of the year 2015. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves Peter Lavenda, author of, among other titles, The Hitler Legacy, Ratline, and Unholy Alliance. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be back.
This past week, the news cycle has been dominated by the trip of Pope Francis to the U.S., and I thought that in as much as we were talking about the mysterious Georg Anton Puig, who may or may not have been Adolf Hitler. I hold both possibilities very much open. We were talking about the firm physical evidence that Hitler did not die. Also talking about Operation Nursery, a British intelligence operation put together by MI6 operative Hugh Trevor Roper, which established the official version, unquote, of the death, the quote death, unquote, of Adolf Hitler. It literally was a piece of intelligence propaganda crafted as part of a propaganda network, and and we were comparing that with the Warren Report and how both, in a sense, were sort of like the authorities saying to the rest of us, okay, move along, folks, nothing to see here. And I thought, against the background of Georg Anton Puig and Pope Francis's trip to the U.S., it might be worth reviewing and delving into at greater length something called the Ratline. And I think a point of entry might be Father, and I don't know how his first name is pronounced, Krunoslav Draganovich.
Yes.
Tell us about Father Draganovich, the significance of his name in the Puig journal, and about what the Ratline was before we get into some specifics.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Monsignor Draganovich was, of course, a Croatian Catholic priest, a Monsignor, who was very well connected with the Nazi puppet regime called the Ustashi, which was a ultra-nationalistic group of Croatians who basically despised their fellow Serbians. The Serbians were largely Eastern Orthodox. The Croatians were largely Catholic with some Muslims. And, of course, there were the Bosnians as well, which were largely Muslim. So Yugoslavia was divided between at least three different ethnic groups with some dissimilarities in languages and definite dissimilarity in religion. The Balkans was the part of the world that had been crisscrossed numerous times by various European and Middle Eastern forces. You had Ottomans coming in, going up from Turkey into the Balkans, going into Europe as far as Vienna. You had Europeans fighting back into the other direction, beating the Muslim armies and the Turkish armies back into Turkey. So the Balkans was crisscrossed by very many different kinds of groups, different types of religious groups. The headquarters, of course, for the Orthodox Church was in Constantinople, which is now today Istanbul in Turkey. So you had a large Eastern Orthodox contingent in the Balkans, and you had, of course, a large Roman Catholic contingent, which was the Croatians, and you had a large Muslim contingent in the Balkans as well. Albania is largely Muslim, for instance, still to this day. So you have that part of the world is fascinating. It's composed of many different types of people, of cultures, of ethnicities, languages, but in World War II, at that time, it was Yugoslavia. It was a kind of a one nation composed of all of these various elements, which, with the coming of the Second World War, provided an opportunity for these various elements to try to gain the ascendancy in the Balkans. And what happened was the Croatian government was essentially a puppet Nazi government. It was run by a man called Ante Pavelic. He was the president of Croatia. They met with the Pope. The Ustashi would go to the Vatican. There's a very famous photograph showing Ustashi leaders with Pope Pius XII there in Rome. So you had this close connection between the Ustashi, who were violently anti-communist and violently pro-Roman Catholic, siding, of course, with the Nazis. This is the background. This is what was going on in the 1940s in Europe. We had the Catholic Church in Spain under Franco, in Italy, of course, in Germany under people like Alois Hudal and various other high-ranking clerics in Italy and in Germany and in Austria were all either violently pro-Nazi, I mean extremely aggressively pro-Nazi, or they saw the Nazis simply as the lesser of two evils in the fight against communism. So into this morass of different warring factions and the Catholic Church siding with Nazi forces in Croatia, you have Father Krunoslav Draganovic. Draganovic was a Monsignor who was also a very clever intelligence operative. He was the person who was in charge of rescuing the entire Ustashi government when it was about to fall to the partisan forces in Croatia, as well as to British saboteurs and spies who were infiltrating into that part of the world. The Nazis were having a very hard time holding on to Croatia. When it looked like it was about to fall, this was about 1943 or so, it was Father Draganovic who organized the escape of virtually the entire political administration of the Ustashi, including Ante Pavelic. Their escape, using the Catholic Church's assets in northern Italy all the way to Genoa, where they would be able to board ships using forged documents provided by the Catholic Church, and then make their way to Argentina. And that wasn't all of it, though. Draganovic was also in charge of making sure the tangible assets were also recovered and saved, which meant the gold and all the other valuables that the criminal Ustashi government had taken from their enemies within Yugoslavia, which meant taking it from Serbians, taking it from people who were communists, from the partisans. They were involved in the same kind of seizure of assets that the Nazis were in the occupied eastern territories, going into museums, going into churches, going into people's homes, and seizing whatever was valuable and hauling it off. The Ustashi had been doing the same thing. So during this, in this particular context, we have Draganovic in charge of all of this. He needed the money, in some cases, to pay bribes to get the Ustashi people safely out of Croatia, out of Yugoslavia, through the safe houses, the rat line. The very first rat line was the monastery route, as they called it, which was a series of monasteries, convents, churches, various Catholic safe houses that led all the way down into Rome and over into Genoa. And he managed to get them all escaped. I mean, Pavelic wound up in Argentina, as well as most of his lieutenants. They were all safely in Argentina by war's end. And so was a lot of the money, the gold, whatever else had been seized. We have to recall that the regime in Croatia under the Ustashi was, if not the most brutal in Europe at that time during World War II, it certainly was second to none. It was right up there with the Holocaust in general. The Holocaust was taking place in Croatia, and it was taking place in a way that is hard for us to understand or to believe today against the backdrop of the visit of Pope Francis to the United States and the popularity that suddenly the Catholic Church is enjoying right now. Against this backdrop, we have to remember that the concentration camps in Croatia were run by Catholic priests. Catholic priests were involved in physically killing concentration camp prisoners. They were involved in forcibly converting Serbian Orthodox civilians to Catholicism and then machine gunning them outside the church after they had been baptized in the Catholic Church.
Peter, you talk about Father Filipovic, am I pronouncing that name, and his associate Father Brucallo, and a contest that they are a type of contest that they engaged in at Jasenovac, the largest Ustashi concentration camp. I wonder if you would detail that for us.
Certainly. The concentration camp in question, Jasenovac, was infamous. You might as well have basically picked up Auschwitz and taken it entirely into Croatia. I mean, this was an Arbeitmacht frei kind of an institution, but it was really an extermination camp. The numbers that we're talking about between, somewhere between 60 and 100,000 people were slaughtered at that camp under Roman Catholic organizers and camp commanders. So we have these two priests that you mentioned, Filipovic, and the other name was...
Brucallo,
yeah. So Brucallo and Filipovic were two priests, two Catholic priests, and they had a contest. And their contest would be how many people they could kill. Children, we're talking about Serbian children, they would have contests how many they could kill with their bare hands, basically strangling Serbian children. This was their contest.
And you note that those are the same hands with which they would then on Sundays administer the sacrament to their parishioners.
Exactly. You cannot imagine anything more hideous. If you are a believing Roman Catholic, how could you get on board this image of the priest on Saturday strangling small children with his bare hands, and then the next day performing the sacrament of the Mass, changing the bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ? Only the sickest kind of horror film screenwriter could come up with something like this. And by the way, they have not. I think even they would draw the line at something this hideous. And yet this is what was going on. This is what was known. In fact, eventually, Filipovic, I believe, was executed at the end of the war as a war criminal. But these are the kind of people that Draganovich was trying to save, to help them to escape, to get them into Argentina. And there's something that we should also mention, perhaps, about Argentina, since we're on the subject, sort of tangentially, of Pope Francis's visit. Pope Francis, of course, is an Argentine of Italian ethnicity. What we had in Argentina during the time when Francis was a priest there and a provincial head of the Jesuit order, the Society of Jesus, in Argentina, what we had was what was called the Dirty War. This was the time when the generals had taken over control of the country from Isabel Perón at that time. They instituted this draconian measures of search and seizure. They had death squads. One of them was the AAA, which is a death squad that went around snatching people off the streets or breaking into your house in the middle of the night. People disappeared. They were called los desaparecidos, the disappeared ones. One day, you know, your neighbor was there, the next day not. No one ever knew what happened to them, where they wound up. This was going on in the 1970s and 80s at a time when you had someone, there's names that will not be familiar to most Americans. There was a very famous Argentine murderer, a member of the military police, named Raul Giulio Minetti. At the same time that Francis is in Argentina, during the same time that he's in Buenos Aires and running the Society of Jesus and doing other things, a horrific time in Argentine's history, we had people like Giulio Minetti, who was running drugs, laundering money for the Bolivian drug cartel.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
You're wondering what this has to do with anything. Well, the Bolivian drug cartel at the time was being run by a man called Klaus Barbie, very famous Nazi, the Butcher of Lyon, that the United States government had used as a spy in the last days, in the early post-war period, 1946, 47, 48, had helped, along with the rat line, along with Draganovich, with the false papers and all the rest of it, got Klaus Barbie to Bolivia, where he then became very prominent running drugs, not because he had a particular fascination for the drug trade. What he wanted to do was convert those drugs into money, launder the money, which is what Giulio Minetti was doing in Miami, by the way, and running that money then back into the coffers of various neo-Nazi and Nazi organizations throughout the world, one of which was used to finance, some of the money was used to finance the Nicaraguan Contras. This was all part of the drugs for guns for money situation that was happening. And Giulio Minetti was right in the middle of it, a Catholic with Italian background, Italian ethnicity, working with the Nazis, working with Odessa as late as the 1980s, as late as the very end of the Dirty War in Argentina, managed to escape to Spain for a while and was eventually picked up again and sent to prison, where he is now, finally, after all this time. But this is a man who was a murderer, a torturer, an interrogator, and this is the kind of atmosphere that you had in Argentina in those days. I was in Chile in 79, and the atmosphere there was poisonous. And in Argentina, which is right next door, it was just as bad. And you had Barbie operating in 79 in Bolivia with impunity, committing assassinations and terror all over the world with money that was coming from the Nazi underground, some of which was the money that came, of course, from Draganovic, Ante Pavelic, and the Croatian Ustashi, gold that was transferred into Swiss banks and eventually into banks in South America, Argentina. So this is a web, this is a network, and it's not for nothing that the Spanish word for it is la araña, which means the spider web. This is what was taking place. You pull at one strand, which is maybe the Catholic Church in Argentina, and as you pull at that strand, you uncover this entire underworld of connections and of a fanaticism, an anti-communist fanaticism that was kind of the justification for every kind of evil, from strangling small Serbian children with your bare hands as a Catholic priest in Croatia, to committing assassinations in Italy and in Spain, Argentina, and even in Washington, D.C., as we spoke about. We have this kind of a network of like-minded individuals who are all in this together. Now, I'm not saying that Pope Francis is culpable for any of this, but we're dealing with a pope who was an Argentine, who grew up in that environment, who was a chemical engineer at first, who had studied chemical engineering before going into the priesthood. Somebody who was connected enough with the oligarchy in Argentina, who had the financing and the funds, was able to get around and do a lot of things. He might have been a saint in Argentina. We think that from some of the stories we have, he tried to help people to escape the generals. He tried to do what he could. But he said something very interesting during this trip. There was controversy, of course, over the canonization of Junipero Serra, the Catholic missionary who opened so many missions in California, which entailed, of course, acts of brutality and oppression against the Native American population. He said, we should not judge the past through the context of the present, that things happened in the past the way they happened. We shouldn't judge them from the basis of where we're standing now. And I thought to myself, that's probably what he's telling himself. It probably has not just to do with Father Serra in California. It may have to do with a lot of things. It may have to do with the Catholic Church's position during World War II in covert and overt support for the Nazi regime and for helping the war criminals to escape. And it may have to do with what happened in Argentina during the Dirty Wars and what otherwise honorable or decent men and women found themselves forced to do, found themselves making choices that no matter what they did was going to be wrong. They were going to be criticized for. There were unethical choices no matter how you looked at it. Sophie's choice kind of situation. So this is what was being supported by people who had gone through seminary, who had been ordained, who had gone through training to be parish priests, people who had gone to training who baptized children. I mean, you baptize children one day and then murder them the next. This is something that Robert Lifton called doubling. He tried to explain, he tried to understand how medical doctors in the German concentration camps, in the German death camps, people who had been trained to save lives, people who had families, people who were married and had children and played with their children in the houses that they lived in outside the walls of the death camps, could go into the death camps and supervise mass slaughter and then go home and play with their kids. This was something Lifton calls doubling, a kind of a psychological splitting of the personality. And maybe this is what was going on. It's not an excuse for sure, but it is an observation. It is perhaps an explanation for this, because I don't see any other way that we can explain this. It's beyond explanation.
Something, Peter, I would like to return to not only the subject briefly of Father Serra, but another Catholic priest who, although he has not been canonized, he has been beatified, and that is Archbishop Stepanak, who was actually a part of the Ustashi Parliament in the Croatian satellite puppet state of Nazi Germany. But I think that to maybe flesh out people's understanding of the rat line, and also to indicate how the dynamics that we are talking about and that you just set forth intersect with, network with, relate with other very powerful institutions. On pages 144 and 146 of Ratline, you relate the story of, on the one hand, Operation Bernhard and the SS officer Friedrich Schwend, who oversaw that. And I wonder if you would relate about what Operation Bernhard was. Who was Friedrich Schwend, and how does that relate to some of the other things we're talking about? The operation of the Rat Line, the fascist and Nazi networks in Latin America associated with Klaus Barbie, with Operation Condor was going to Colonia Dignidad, and I'm sure listeners remember the hair-raising account of your visit to Colonia Dignidad, and something that was very much present in the Junta, which was the Argentine branch of the P2 Lodge, or Propaganda Due Lodge, primarily Italian, but with a very powerful branch in Argentina. So Bernhard, Friedrich Schwend, the Rat Line, Condor, and how these networks develop and their connections with institutions that survive to this day, like CIA and others.
Wow, yes, of course, that's...
In 25 words or less.
Or less, yes, okay. Well, let's start with Stepanak then, in that case. Archbishop Stepanak has been beatified. He's someone that the Catholic Church would like to make a saint. Here he was, by all accounts, a decent human being, a pious archbishop, but he was part of the Ustashe regime because he was anti-communist. And to be anti-communist, you found yourself being pro-Nazi in those days. Those were the only two options you had. Like red states and blue states, you could only be either anti-communist and pro-Nazi, or anti-Nazi and pro-communist. You were either, you know, a communist or a Nazi. And you couldn't be a communist in Croatia unless you were one of the partisans. So Stepanac is part of the establishment, as part of the established religion, was somebody who helped the Ustashe, somebody who offered moral support, if nothing else. But then towards the end, when they were trying to escape, like rats deserting a sinking ship, a lot of the money that had been seized by the Ustashe from the local people, from the Serbians, from people they didn't like, from communists, from whatever Jews they could find, all of that wound up being smelted into gold bars and transferred in gold coins and other ways into church hiding. The churches were, as I mentioned before, the monastery route was an essential part of the escape routes, a perfect, actually, vehicle for escaping Nazis and for escaping money as well. And in Stepanac's case, a lot of the money that was being stolen from the people by the Ustashe wound up in his cathedral, buried and hidden in his cathedral. He allowed the Ustashe to bury their gold there, or to hide it, if not bury it, but to keep it in hiding in his cathedral. And Draganovic was part of that. He arranged it with Stepanac. And as we spoke about, a lot of that money went on to finance Odessa, finance the escape of the Nazis, but to finance their activities later, along with the rest of the Nazi gold that managed to disappear from Europe in the last days of the war. So you had Stepanac very firmly, you know, involved in this. And the Catholic Church wants to make him a saint. And the reason is, under, you know, John Paul II, you had a pope at that time, a Polish pope, who was the sort of poster boy for anti-communism. And, you know, someone like Stepanac would have been right in the same mold. So Pope John II, rather, John Paul II, wanted to canonize Stepanac. There is a famous photograph of him kneeling in front of the tomb of Stepanac during the beatification procedures. And there's a high school in New York City, which is the Archbishop Stepanac High School. So he's considered to be this very important, very prominent Catholic clergyman, very prelate of the Catholic Church, a prince of the Church, who was also very much involved with these very people we've been discussing. Now, I don't know how deeply he would have supported the fact that his priests were running a concentration camp and killing children with their bare hands, actually having contests to see how many you could kill in one sitting with your bare hands. I don't know if he would have supported all of that, but he probably would have told himself, this is all part of the fight against communism. We are trying to destroy communism. Communism is atheism. We can't let this satanic movement spread. So these excesses are acceptable. In other words, crossing the line and saying the end justifies the means. So this is the beginning of an entirely new economic and political situation in the world, at which time, running parallel, you had Freddy Schwend. Freddy Schwend, or Friedrich Schwend, had an SS rank. He was a Sturmbannführer in the SS, which was kind of just a cover title that he had so that he could operate freely. He was involved with something called Operation Bernhard. Bernhard was the project that the SS had developed as part of a major program to destabilize Western currency. And the way they were going to do this was they were going to forge British pound sterling notes and flood the market with these forged British pound notes, with the expectation that that would destabilize the British currency and the British economy would fall. This is all part of this very long-term plan. It wasn't just the British pound notes. It was virtually every kind of foreign currency of all of their enemies, including U.S. dollars. They were going to forge all of this money, flood the market, and destroy the currencies, destroy the world currencies. So the immediate aim was to destabilize the world economy. But there was a secondary aim as well, which is that they could use this forged currency to help prop up the efforts of the rat lines, the escape routes, to establish bank accounts in foreign countries, as long as no one realized these were forgeries. And these were very good forgeries. That's Schwend's expertise, was as a forger. And he had actually working with him at this villa a number of Jewish concentration camp prisoners who were also experts in art, in engraving, in lithography, and all the various things that he needed to create these foreign currencies. So the Nazis were not above using slave labor for this purpose, as well as for making rockets and for doing all the other stuff that the Jewish slave labor was used for.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
So Schwend then is doing all of this. He's creating all these forged currencies. They are shipping these currencies by truckload and by trainload throughout Europe into safe parts where they could then be dispersed. We're talking about a huge operation. This wasn't just you're running off a few million dollars or a few million pounds sterling. This was running off truckloads of foreign currency. Who knows? There could be some of that still floating around the world today in various places. But Schwend was eventually captured or apprehended by the Counterintelligence Corps, the CIC, at the end of the war. This is the same CIC, the same Counterintelligence Corps that was deeply involved with the rat lines out of Salzburg in Austria with Father Krunoslav Draganovich. Draganovich worked for, at one point, the CIC. After he got the Croatians out. Let's not go into the Ukrainians, that's another story. But when he got the Croatians out, he came to the attention of American intelligence, rather, in the American sector of Austria in Salzburg, the CIC. And he was, in a sense, turned. So Draganovich was working for CIC to identify potential recruits that the Americans and the Allies could use in their upcoming war against the Soviet Union. So Draganovich then suddenly found himself the golden boy, whereas he had been running with the Croatian Ustashi, trying to get as many Nazis out of Europe as possible and as much of Nazi gold out of Europe as possible. Now he found himself actually working with the Counterintelligence Corps, working with American military intelligence to identify potential recruits that they could turn and use as spies against the East for the burgeoning Galen organization, which was Reinhard Gehlen, a general of military intelligence, running operations against Eastern Europe and against the Soviets. Draganovich was kind of in the same position. He was looking for Nazis that who could work with the Americans. One of those, of course, turned out to be Klaus Barbie, who eventually was extradited in the 80s back to France to stand trial. Barbie was another sadist. He was called the Butcher of Lyon. Here was a man who had no scruples whatsoever, who had a taste for blood and for torture and sadism, and wound up running the Secret Service of Bolivia in the 1970s, and running drugs and running guns, created his own little operation called the Fiancés of Death, very melodramatically, but was also a key element of Operation Condor, which was, of course, the pan-Latin American operation that was used to commit assassinations and terror operations in North America, South America, and Europe. So all of these people are very much connected. Schwend was then working for our CIC, working for the Americans, right? Helping them find some of the stolen assets, some of the Nazi gold, some of the currencies, but not too much, just enough to make sure that he had job security, but not too much that would destroy the Ratline operation. And they gave him this weird name. The code name was Major Klemp, which sounds like something out of Hogan's Heroes. And another code name, which was called Flush. Flush was used because he was supposed to, you know, flush out people like him in Italy, where then he was then taken. He was supposed to know who the other forgers were, who the other SS intelligence people were, and to kind of, you know, reveal the elements of the rat lines, which he really didn't do very well. He wound up eventually in South America himself, working alongside his old friends there, working alongside people like Klaus Barbie, working with Walter Rauch, Eric Priebke, and the others in South America, the famous Nazi underground there. Schwend was part of their operation. He died in 1980, as far as I remember. But he was using, along with Draganovich, the same escape routes to move people and to move assets out of Europe and anywhere around the world where they could be taken away from control by the Allies. So, and at the same time, he's identifying, along with Draganovich, people that could be used to help strengthen the Gehlen organization, which was the forerunner, actually, of the CIA's Eastern Europe operations. Gehlen organization was all the CIA had for a while in operating against the Soviet Union, all former Nazis, just as, you know, our rocket program and our space program had to rely upon hundreds of former Nazi scientists and engineers, rocket scientists, engineers, and medical officers. So the CIA was using former Nazis, mostly SS and Gestapo, hiring murderers back into uniform, practically, to run operations against Eastern Europe. Eventually, the Gehlen organization became the West German Intelligence Service, the BND. The Gehlen organization was the heart of the West German intelligence operation. So when all the dust had settled, the Nazis were back doing what they had always done best, to perform anti-communist operations and to swindle the West as much as they possibly could, hiding their money, hiding their personnel, moving things around the globe, committing assassinations and terror operations to continue their original plan, which was to destabilize both the West and the East.
Now, before returning to Archbishop Stepanak very briefly, if you would detail for us, or perhaps encapsulate would be a better word, the P2 Lodge, which again is inextricably linked with the operations of Klaus Barbie, with the Vatican, with Italian fascism, and also with the junta that prosecuted the dirty war. Because you mentioned the P2 Lodge. It is very important, winds through this entire concatenation, and yet it is not something one hears much about.
No, the P2 Lodge came to prominence because of the revelations surrounding Barbie and some of the others briefly, and then sort of dropped out of sight. But it's a much more important story than most people give credit for, because Propaganda Due was a Masonic lodge, kind of an irregular Masonic lodge. That's what they say now. At the time, it was not considered that irregular. It was a regular Masonic lodge, but the membership was almost entirely composed of dedicated anti-communists. It was basically an anti-communist or a pro-fascist cell, whose members all knew each other, whose members had taken oaths to support each other in their operations. It contained not only businessmen in Italy and other parts of Europe. It was not only restricted to Italians. There were people from Germany, Austria involved with it. There were members, you might call them associate members, in the United States and in Latin America, all members of P2, some of the famous financiers of political operations, assassinations, and terror operations. People like Licio Gelli, Roberto Calvi were members of P2 and operated with P2. There were banks in the United States and around the world, including the Vatican Bank, that were intimately connected with this Masonic Lodge's operations. The money that was being laundered through the Vatican Bank and through Banco Ambrosiano, again, banks that were basically used only to launder money, very similar to the Nugan Hand Bank in Australia, the bank BCCI, which was involved in all sorts of skullduggery and CIA operations and everything else. Banco Ambrosiano was one of them, and of course the Vatican Bank itself, under Archbishop Marcinkus, who was an American, I believe from Chicago, who was running that operation, in control of the bank to launder money and to create false paperwork trails for this money, to transfer money around the world secretly, impervious to international law regarding banking. This was all set up as an anti-communist operation, which was designed to root out first the Italian Communist Party out of Italy and all the socialist stuff that was going on then, and then to go throughout the other countries. We had the possibility of socialist parties rising to prominence in Austria and in Germany and other parts of Western Europe, as well as in Latin America, of course. So Propaganda Due was involved in all of this. This was the club for these guys who were involved in this, in these takeovers worldwide. And it included people in the Catholic Church up to and including the rank of cardinal. So you had very prominent clergymen. There are not that many cardinals. And if you have cardinals as members of Propaganda Due, of any Masonic lodge, which in the first place is supposed to be illegal, you know, you can't be a Catholic priest and a Freemason. This is a conflict of interest, let's say. And the Church has always said you cannot be a Catholic and a Freemason. I think that was relaxed in the last few years or so, but I know when I was a kid, I could not join the De Molay Society or anything like that, since I was going to Catholic school and brought up a Catholic. The Masons, to us in those days, the 1950s and 1960s, were considered sort of borderline satanic. And yet here you had, you know, cardinals joining this lodge, because these cardinals in particular were notoriously anti-communist, and they felt the Church was being too soft on communism. You remember, perhaps in the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, Latin America was a hotbed of the liberation movements, which were movements to support the poor, to support the oppressed in Latin American countries that were largely being run by Catholic priests and nuns. It was called liberation theology, and you had this wide movement of Catholics who were suddenly had a social conscience and who were going to fight against the people who were running those countries. So you had assassinations even of archbishops in South America. You had imprisonment. You had priests who were being captured, killed, and tortured. You had nuns who were being killed by these same people on the orders of people within the hub of Propaganda Due. This is what they were up to at that time. So when John Paul I was elected Pope, back at that time, around 1980, he promised that what he was going to do was clean up the Church, get rid of all of this, close down that bank, you know, try to figure out what was going on with Banco Ambrosiano and the Vatican Bank and Marcinkus and all of this stuff, get rid of this once and for all, and especially go after Propaganda Due, because Lo Osservatore Romano and the other newspapers in Italy started publishing lists that they had captured of Catholic prelates who were members of Propaganda Due. So John Paul I came out very strongly against them, and he was dead 33 days later. The scuttlebutt is, of course, that he was poisoned. A lot of people say, well, that's just conspiracy theory, but how convenient that the John Paul I, who was going to destroy this infrastructure within the church that was political, that was economic, and that was engaged in assassinations and terrorism, that was intimately linked with fascism and with Nazi parties throughout the world, including, of course, the famous Odessa. How interesting that he would die within a month, roughly, and be replaced by the most vociferous anti-communist pope, John Paul II.
A couple of quick details. The predecessor to JP I, of course, was Paul VI, who previously had been Cardinal Giovanni Battista Montini and had been involved at an executive level with the diaspora of very important Nazis moving through the rat line. And ultimately, when the Vatican banking scandals unfolded and the Banco Ambrosiano, the guy who was appointed by JP II to sort of set things straight was Hermann Abs from the Deutsche Bank. Which,
yes, right.
If that isn't the case of appointing the fox to guard the hen house.
Oh, it was the whole thing was a scandal. To anybody who followed these things, to Vatican insiders, not only Vatican insiders, but to anyone who followed this with any degree of care, noticed immediately, you know, what was taking place. As you mentioned, Paul VI was Cardinal Montini. As Cardinal Montini, he was in charge of Caritas. Caritas, the Latin word that means charity. Caritas was the organization that, among other things, was running interference for the Nazis, making sure they had, you know, their fake Nazi, the fake Vatican passports and Vatican ID papers so they could get International Red Cross passports and that sort of thing. This was Paul VI. This was Montini. This was, you know, you had Nazis, you know, first, you had Montini, and then you had poor John Paul I, who didn't have a chance, dead after a month, and then John Paul II comes back in, and as you say, appoints some very prominent members of the former Reich to in charge of, you know, finding out what's going wrong at the Vatican. It's just, it's stunning. Absolutely stunning.
It really is. And again, the P2 Lodge, with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard, very much involved with Vatican politics, very much involved with Italian politics, and also, again, with people like Admiral Emilio Massera, who headed up the Naval Mechanics School, and General Carlos Suarez Nason, and I believe also Jorge Videla, the actual head of the junta. Argentine P2 members were prominently represented in that junta.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Peter, we have spoken about the Nazi diaspora and also how related groups like the Romanian Iron Guard, the Hungarian Arrow Cross, and the Croatian Ustashi found stewardship with the Galen organization and then were involved moving to the U.S. and gaming American politics in a rightward direction. A fascinating detail that you related might seem irrelevant to some, but Archbishop Stepanac's name was lent to a high school that was formed in the late 1940s with the blessing of Cardinal Spellman, one of the most important of the right-wing officials of the American Catholic Church. And in Ratline, you relate something very unusual about Archbishop Stepanac High School. I wonder if you would relate that to us.
Well, sure. People who've read my books or followed what I do, realize that I kind of go as deep as I can into the weeds on something, just to find out what's there, what's going on. And in the case of the high school, I was, you know, I had not heard of Archbishop Stepanac High School, even though I'm from New York City, but, you know, there are a lot of schools, and I didn't really focus on that one. But then I decided, wow, there's a school opened by Spelman, of all people, in the late 1940s, which is a very suggestive time. Why would you, you know, open a high school in, like, 1948 and name it after this archbishop? So I went to their website. Like most organizations these days, they have their own website. And I figured, let me look and see who's gone to that high school, because that might be interesting to see. Maybe there's people today in positions of importance or prominence in politics or industry or somewhere, who've gone to this high school named after this kind of controversial guy. And I found I couldn't log on. You can go to the high school's website. It's all full of the usual fluff that you find. But when you try to look up the alumni, there is a page for that where you can click and look up the alumni. But in order to do that, you have to be an alumnus yourself. You have to have gone to that high school and then gotten a password, which allows you to get into the high school's website and look up the alumni. I found that to be very strange. And I thought to myself, well, maybe everybody does that. Maybe that's something that people do or high schools do for reasons that escape me. So I went to my own high school website. I'm a proud alumnus of Christopher Columbus High School. And logged on to their website, and without any problem at all, was able to go into their lists of alumni, the list that they publish. I mean, I don't imagine every single alumnus is there, but they do, you know, they do have enough names that you can sort of browse through the alumni list at Columbus High School, but you can't do that with Archbishop Stepanac High School, and I can't figure out the reason for that. Why would an alumni list be secret? Why would it be password protected? There's nothing else on that site that is. And that just sort of made me extremely curious.
I would note, first of all, first in passing, that a high school or a college verifying that someone had graduated from there would be a very important thing for a potential employer, for example, to be able to access. I mean, if someone, if you have a candidate for a job position and they say, well, yeah, I graduated from high school, I went to Archbishop Stepanac High School, you would think that verifying that would be necessary at one level and easy at another. To me, this raises more questions than it provides answers, but I wonder if perhaps Archbishop Stepanac High School might have, to an extent anyway, provided cover for the diaspora of some of these same elements, whether perhaps one could refer to Stepanac High School as part of the Pavelic legacy. I don't know. What are your thoughts in that regard before we move on?
Well, yeah, it occurred to me as well. I mean, you know, suddenly you're looking at a high school website and you're thinking skull and bones, you know. I mean, why would their membership list be private, be password protected and secret? And I try to find out, how do I get a password? And you have to prove that you were, you know, a member of that high school, that you had gone to that high school. I mean, are you kidding me? Really? You know, so obviously they are providing cover for someone, something, or their students in general. Perhaps the high school is more controversial even than I'm aware of, but and briefly, I just don't know. It's just the strangest thing.
You would think that pride in having graduated would be part of the school pride, so to speak,
exactly,
that they always talk about, but not in this case. Peter, in the first of your books that I read, Unholy Alliance, there were many things that came to mind, some of which we have already covered in some of the interviews that we have done to date. I was stunned to read in Unholy Alliance that the sort of media posse that worked to discredit Ladislaus Farrago's book Aftermath about the search for Martin Bormann in Latin America had been led by none other than Gerald Posner, who is perhaps best known to members of the audience for having written Case Closed, which is, you know, just nonsense about the JFK assassination. He also took the lone nut version of Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination as well. Both are untenable. In past programs, I've accessed some of Paul Manning's correspondence, and he was told in his researches into the Bormann organization that, in fact, Heinrich Müller, the former head of the Gestapo, and according to Manning and others, part of the security director for the Bormann network, deliberately set Ladislav Farago up with a photograph that could be used to discredit him, and that was then leaked to the New York Times, which also, of course, published the Warren Report. I wonder if you, when we've got about 8 minutes left here.
Sure.
I wonder if you would sort of flesh that out for us, and what are your thoughts in that regard? I find it hard to believe that Gerald Posner just, you know, waltzed in and said, oh gosh, I guess I'm going to discredit Ladislav Farago. So tell us about Farago, his adventures in Latin America, and what you wrote about in Unholy Alliance.
Well, Ladislav Farago, for me, was a very important author and a very important source, because the book Aftermath is basically what got me to South America, to Colonia Dignidad in the first place. His book, Farago was a historian of World War II, a very well-respected historian. He wrote Game of the Foxes, one of the best accounts of the intelligence operations during World War II. He wrote Patton, the biography of Patton, which eventually was made into a film. Farago was not a slouch. He was not a conspiracy theorist. He was not one of these sort of armchair journalists. Farago did, it was an inspiration to me, because what he did, I decided I would have to do as well, which meant actually going places and digging things up and going to foreign countries and taking some risks in order to get at what is really going on and not to rely upon printed media alone. So Farago was important for me for that reason. And Aftermath is a very important book. No matter what people say, especially Posner, who ridiculed Farago, to me, I mean, the vitriol that he used to attack him was totally uncalled for. I don't know, you know, if you're only thinking of people in terms of the way we understand people, we grow up with people, we, you know, we are colleagues. It's what Posner did was unconscionable. So there had to be an ulterior motive to what Posner is doing. And then his later books, of course, pretty much demonstrate to me that he is a shill for a kind of an establishment point of view on everything. Yes, there, you know, Oswald acted alone, and James Earl Ray acted alone. Everybody was alone, and there is no possible conspiracy anywhere, anytime, at any place. And Farago is characterized as a dupe, as a fool, as being dishonest. These are things that, if you follow Farago's career, if you had read Aftermath with any care at all, you would see this man was going out of his way, going into very dangerous circumstances to try to uncover the truth about what might have been the most famous World War II escaped refugee of all time, would have Martin Bormann. As long as we posit that Hitler did not escape, number two would be Martin Bormann. Bormann was the money man. Bormann was the organization man behind the Third Reich after the flight of Rudolf Hess to England. Bormann became number two. Bormann was the guy who knew where the money was. Bormann knew how the money was being laundered, how the gold was getting out of Europe, where it was going. Bormann was the guy who was involved in all of this. And I have to give you credit, Dave, because you're like virtually the only place on the internet where anybody has really focused on Paul Manning's work where Bormann is concerned. The people who dismiss the work of Paul Manning are just like the people who dismiss the work of Farago. They're dismissing it just for ad hominem reasons. They're dismissing it on purely, you know, stylistic, well, we don't believe this. It can't be. We know Bormann is dead. So the entire work is dismissed as being worthless. They do the same thing with Farago's book. Bormann couldn't have survived. He could not have been alive. We know he was dead. We found his skull at least two or three different times in Berlin, in two or three different places. So we know that that Bormann was dead at least three times.
Just like Adolf Hitler.
Exactly. The same. Just like Adolf Hitler. And remember, the Soviets called their version of Operation Nursery. They called their version Operation Myth. And that's their official name for this whole fandango they did with supposedly Hitler's and Eva's bodies that they drove all over Europe and then eventually dug up and cremated, and et cetera, and then the fake skull in Moscow. It's called Operation Myth for a reason. Operation Myth and Operation Nursery, they're peas in a pod. And so we're dealing with Posner, who's doing the same thing as Hugh Trevor Roper, basically, and insisting that Bormann, you know, died in Berlin in May of 1945. Nothing to see here. Move along. And anybody who says differently, like a respected historian like Farrago, who actually went throughout South America looking and trying to follow up leads and trying to figure out what was going on, to destroy that man's reputation, to me, was totally beyond the pale. And nobody could do that unless they were purely the kind of armchair shill that Posner is. You know, Posner did nothing as far as actually going and looking for Bormann, or Mengele, for that matter. This was a guy who based his research on whatever people handed to him after the fact. Farrago put his life on the line. He went down there and looked. And what he uncovered in the process is amazing. Now, you don't have to believe that Bormann escaped. You don't have to believe, along with Paul Manning, that Bormann escaped with the cash. Although the evidence that Manning provides is really strong, I would say irrefutable. You don't have to believe that at all. Read Aftermath, read Paul Manning, and come up with your own conclusions as to what was really going on in South America in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Peter, we're almost out of time here. One of the things that I found very interesting about your account of your hair-raising trip to Colonia Dignidad, when I was in contact with Peter Manning, Paul Manning's son, who gave me a lot of supplemental material that is now up on my website. The Manning family, which really wanted to let the whole episode go because they were traumatized, they warned Peter. They said, you know, speaking of the Bormann organization, they said, quote, you know, basically, they'll get you fired from your job. And that's exactly what happened to you, is it not, when you came back from Colonia Dignidad?
Yes, exactly what happened. I came back. I worked for the Bendix Corporation at the time. I had gone down in July, in June, actually, 1979, came back in July of 79. It was a legitimate vacation that I had applied for and taken, which I had deserved. There's nothing untoward about that. But I came back, and within 30 days, I was out of a job.
Yep.
And interestingly enough, within that same time period, Jack Anderson's column published a column on Colonia Dignidad, based on information they got from CIA and Amnesty International. And it's in that time frame that I was out of a job. Not only that, but I also found myself on a street in Queens, New York, walking down the street, and a man walks up to me, a very properly dressed individual in a white sort of ice cream suit, a Latin, I thought, from his accent. And he walked up to me, and he touched me on the shoulder and said, "Don't worry, you know, you're safe. You're among friends here." And then he walked away. And this is after about a week after I had come back, and I had been shouted at by a bunch of guys in a taxi who passed by me, very big, burly guys in a yellow cab, who started screaming at me that I was a Jew, that I deserved to be shot, that I deserved to die. I turned a corner, going down a one-way street. They couldn't follow me, so I managed to escape them, but it looked like they wanted to jump out and beat me to a pulp. So all of this was happening after I came back from the colony.
Wow, and I guess good cop, bad cop, but anonymous under the circumstances.
Yeah.
Peter, tell people where they can get Ratline and your other books.
I'd be happy to. Basically, the easiest place is on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can look up these books on their websites, order them that way. Barnes & Noble and some of their stores do carry my books from time to time, so that's a place to look as well.
All righty. And this concludes For the Record program number 865, interview with Peter Lavenda about Ratline and Unholy Alliance. This is being recorded on September 27th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.